and left a reading. We take a reading of it, say, we call that reading PL1. Then we adjust, say, the bandpass filter with a wider bandpass, and then we take another power reading on the meter, and we call that PN2. Then if we wanted to see which one is, you know, how much noise here, we could then take that, I think that's what they're alluding to, take that 10 log of PN2 divided by PN1, and this would tell you how many dB noisier in this situation the amplifier is. I believe that's what they're most likely were questioning me about. I think they showed that in a number of, you know, receiver tests and everything, you know, or the readouts of the receiver specifications. Does that sound like what they most might be alluding to if the filter's over?
Yeah, this is a tough one, I'll warn you. By the way, the formula Mel just gave me, noise power equals K times T0 times V bandwidth. KTV, noise equals KTV. And quite often we'll talk about a state-of-the-art receiver that gets down to KTV. What are we talking about? What we're really saying is that a room temperature resistor, and room temperature is defined by the IEEE as 290 degrees Kelvin, which is something like 23 degrees centigrade, which is something like 65 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm not sure of the exact number there. But 290 Kelvin is the exact number defined as room temperature. You plug in all the numbers for temperature being 290 Kelvin, that's the T0, plug in Boltzmann constant, and you plug in bandwidth of 1 megacycle, you come up with a very interesting number. KTB at room temperature for an impedance-matched resistor, I'll explain that in a minute, is minus 114 dBm per megacycle. Very magic number. If you're into receivers, and you want to instantaneously know, does the guy have a good receiver or a bad receiver, and you know that a room temperature 50 ohm resistor, for instance, will give you a noise power into an ideal receiver of minus 114 dBm per megacycle. The exact number is minus 13.9975, something like that. Call it 114. If somebody then asks you, what happens if I make it a 25 ohm resistor instead of a 50 ohm resistor? And I re-impedance match the receiver, so it's now a 25 ohm resistor, 25 ohm impedance receiver, so that all the noise power made by the receiver, by the resistor, by the dummy load, goes into that receiver, gets absorbed. I'll measure the exact same number, minus 114. So as long as your source of noise is impedance matched to the receiver, it doesn't matter if it's a 1 ohm resistor, a 25 ohm resistor, a 50 ohm resistor, or a 5,000 ohm resistor. What's going on here? That resistor is made up of individual molecules. Those individual molecules get some electrons in orbit around those nucleuses. And the thing that is never made clear in all of our schools is what the hell is temperature. Well, we say it's the amount of hot and cold. And someone says, no, you're not supposed to use that. Well, it's a lack of heat. Or it's more cold and less cold. All of those things are nice words. They don't convey the concept. Temperature is that thing that's measured with a thermometer, with a thermistor, with an infrared camera, with a whole lot of things. What is it really measuring? Average kinetic energy of a molecule. If I had two bulbs sitting on the table, and before you arrived into the room, I aimed a blowtorch at one of them for 10 seconds, but not the other. And I told you, pick up those two bulbs and tell me which one is heavier. And you think you're going to make a weight measurement with your left hand and your right hand. All of a sudden, you drop the one in your right hand. And I say, what's happened? He says, that's hot. What happened? The exact same bolt. What happened is that blowtorch did something to the molecules of that bolt, increased its average kinetic energy. Because it's a solid, those molecules are not moving. They're sitting in space. They're dancing in place. But the ones that I aim the blowtorch at are dancing more violently. Therefore, the free electrons going around those molecules are moving faster, and they're making more noise. There's an exact linear relationship between absolute temperature in Kelvin and the amount of noise power an impedance matched resistor makes. That 50 ohm resistor at room temperature has a certain amount of kinetic energy of those electrons and they're making noise. It happens to be exactly minus 114 dBm if I measure it with a 1 megacycle bandwidth filter. As long as it's impedance matched. And it's hard to believe that if I take a resistor of 1 ohm instead of 50 ohm and put it into a 1 ohm impedance matched receiver, I'll measure the exact same power. Because I've got the exact same amount of shake of those electrons. That's what temperature is, the average kinetic energy of the shape. They're moving around in space. In other words, they're all locked into a lattice. They're not moving. That's what a solid is. They're not moving in total position. It's not changing shape. But they're wiggling in spots. And the hotter ones wiggle faster. And so if I cryogenically cool that 50 ohm resistor and bring it down to 0 Kelvin, what used to be called 0 degrees Kelvin, I've taken away all mechanical motion. All average kinetic energy is gone. Some substances turn superconductive when you do that. But the noise power out of the resistor goes down in exact linear relationship. Half the degrees Kelvin, I get exactly half the noise power output, 3 dB less noise, so to speak. When I go down to 0 degrees Kelvin, cryogenically cool that resistor, all of a sudden it has no noise output. At first it sounds like it's useless. That's a very useful resistor. If I first connect that cryogenic resistor to my receiver and I measure the noise power out of my receiver, all of the noise power coming out of my receiver was made by the receiver. Let me drop for a second. But now, when I put the room temperature resistor in there, I'll measure an increase in noise power coming out of the receiver because I put more noise power in. If the receiver was perfect, I know exactly how much noise power should be coming out in those two circumstances. And if I get a lower ratio of noise power, that receiver is less ideal. That degree of non-ideality of that receiver is called noise trigger, one of the many definitions. So, how does a resistor make noise? Because it's got some heat. Arnold Penzias and Wilson, back in 1967 at Holmdel Laboratory, using that great big Hoghorn antenna, measured the fact that an antenna aimed at what they thought was cold space has 3 degrees Kelvin of noise temperature coming out of space. At first they thought it was the droppings of some pigeons in the horn, and they went and cleaned the antenna and checked all the joints and did everything. They kept coming up with the same number. And they soon realized what they're measuring is the residual of Big Bang. Big Bang, 13.7 billion years ago, made a very hot little fireball in the middle of this universe. All that stuff came flying out of there. It's been slowly cooling down for 13.7 billion years, and it has cooled down to an average temperature of 3 degrees Kelvin. And these two guys at Holmdel measured that and got the Nobel Prize for doing it. They measured the leftover light and heat of this universe at the day of its birth. 13.7 years downrange. So there's a relationship between temperature and noise power. And boy, did they make one hell of a measurement. And got very famous for doing it. And gave us a hell of a lot more understanding of what's going on in this universe. Didn't answer all the questions. Gave us a hell of a lot more questions. But we're a little smarter. So, I know this is off subject. But as you can tell, it's one of my more favorite subjects. Decibels are tough. Noise power density measurements for the purpose of measuring quality of a receiver and noise figure. The first 2 times you read that book, it'll drive you up a wall. You read that section of the reference data for radio engineers, you read the Patai book, P-E-T-A-I, I think it's the author's name, Noise Analysis or something like that, Noise Engineering. The original book was written by Scheib, I think it was. This all came about, and the whole reason of noise figure was created by the charlatans building receivers right after World War II. Mr. Collins built a receiver, Mr. Hallicraft built a receiver, Mr. National built a receiver, and they all claimed lower and lower microvolts of sensitivity. What was really going on is these guys were building more and more narrow filters in the receiver IF strip. A less bandwidth filter receives less noise, and it can receive a weaker signal. That's the good news. But if you make the repeater timeout, cancel. If you make the receiver so narrow that you get a great number of microvolts of sensitivity, and you think you've got a great receiver, but the IF strip is so damn narrow that an amplitude modulated signal comes through there and sounds like the guy is talking through a bale of cotton, and you can't understand them. So you've got a great specification, and you can sell a receiver until it gets received by the customer, and he says, this thing sounds terrible. So along came a guy named Shai, who says, hey, we got to level the playing field here. And he came up with this concept of noise figure, which is a figure of merit of measurement of the quality of a receiver, which is independent of its bandwidth. You measure microvolts of sensitivity of a receiver, you're making a measurement that will go up and down like crazy as you change the bandwidth of the receiver. You measure the noise figure of a receiver with a wide and narrow bandwidth, and you come up with the exact same number. It's a real level playing field when you measure noise figure, when you're trying to measure the sensitivity of a receiver. You read the formulas on noise figure, and you try to study it, it will drive you crazy. There's only 50 ways you can come up with the wrong answer. I've lived in that world for 25 years. I've given talks on that subject a lot of times. I'll warn you guys, it's going to be tough. Are you sure you want to go there? It's going to be a rough ride. K2KEY is attempting to steer this boat. K2RIW in the tech man.
Exactly. This is K2KEY. Exactly. You took the words out of my mouth. And I'll just boil it down to what I said. I gave you this formula with D equals to 10 log of PN2 over PN1, and we talked about different bandwidths. So that the ratio of the two bandwidths, I'll make it simple, the ratio of the two bandwidths that we expressed in dB was given as 10 log of the bandwidth ratio. What does that mean? And it means nothing. There you go. That's what I'll boil it down to. It means nothing. Unless you're really going to talk about ratios of noise power, not bandwidth, that's what we're trying to bring out. There's some misapplication, and that's what you're saying. That's how they juggle the figures to find out what, you know, the possibilities for the receiver by changing the bandwidth and then computing the noise by different bandwidth filters. It means absolutely nothing. Again, if you really want to talk about ratio of noise powers, then you must be not simply bandwidth. This is what the criteria of a receiver should be. By saying it simply, right, Dick, over.
Sign Ed.
Okay. Yes, I agree with what you just said, and what Howie is saying is a sign Ed measurement. To try to level the playing field, Motorola or somebody like that came up with an improvement of what used to be called 20 dB of quiet. In the old days, you would crank up a signal generator in the middle of the receiver test band. You had a good RMS audio voltmeter on the output of the receiver. You measured a certain amount of noise power by turning up the audio gain just right and the RF gain just right. And you took a reference reading. And then you started cranking in a quiet, unmodulated CW signal until the receiver got 20 dB quieting. As the signal got strong, it overloaded the automatic gain control circuit. The automatic gain control circuit cut down the gain. Therefore, the noise power coming out of the receiver went down. And when it got 20 dB quieter, you measured those numbers of microvolts, and you said, aha, I got a good receiver. So that's a medium good measurement. But there's a catch. If I've got a receiver that's got some non-linearity in its amplitude detector, its envelope detector, the detecting diode, which may be the so-called product detector of a sideband receiver, and if I've got an audio amplifier that's not doing so good a job, and it's making distortion, making some second harmonics and whatever, of the audio coming through when somebody is talking to me or when a nice steady tone is coming through, that also is interfering with the ability to listen to that receiver and understand your grandmother's voice over that telephone, so to speak, and maybe a radio circuit between you and your grandmother as part of the telephone circuit. So Motorola or somebody like that came up with this SINAD test, which is signal to noise and distortion ratio. And the way you make that measurement is that you start off with a receiver that I think has no signal going in. You put in a exact we'll say 1 kilohertz amplitude modulated signal of a particular modulation ratio. I think it's like 30% modulation. I'm not positive about, but I think it's around 30%. And you crank up the amplitude of that signal so that what comes out on a distortion meter gets 12 dB better in distortion, 12 dB sine wave. So now you're measuring the fact that the receiver becomes quieter as the signal gets stronger, and you're also looking at whether or not there's any distortion. So the detector circuit is subtracting out the 1 kc sine wave of modulation and looking at everything that's left over. So it's a much more sophisticated measurement. It's, in other words, I can have a receiver that has a great sensitivity, but if it's got a whole lot of distortion in the audio circuit, I'm going to have trouble understanding what the hell the guy is saying. So my SINAD test is measuring not only sensitivity, but the ratio of the sensitivity to distortion. And you put it all together, when it gets 12 dB quieter, including distortion, you say, aha, you now measure the threshold of that receiver in a very repeatable manner, and you've created a pretty level playing field. Is that pretty much your understanding of a SINAD measurement, Howie? Going to be B2HWW, K2IW, the TechNet?
Absolutely. You take our signal generator, you set it up for 1 kc tone at 3 to 5 kc's. Normally you're about just about 5 kc's. You hook up a SINAD meter, which is a 1 kc meter with, a C filter, and you just turn the generator to you just get exactly 12 dB's of quiet. The meter tells you 12 dB's, and you take the microvolt reading or the dB reading. I like to do it in dBs. I just look on the dial, or when I used to do it, I would look on a dial on an IFR 1500, and I knew exactly what it was. Now, what's good about a SINADder is that you can look down line. If you're going through a repeater circuit, you want to look at it through the audio stage, so you can come out on the line card and measure it over a line. If you've got a 600 ohm line, you're not only measuring it at the detector, but you're measuring it through the whole circuit, through the whole loop. Go ahead, Dick.
Turns out Howie gave us another drop. Howie gave us one of a very interesting piece of information. He's starting off with exactly 1 kc pure sine wave of FM modulation of his particular receiver. And he's setting up a particular deviation ratio, a particular bandwidth of FM modulation, like 3 or 5 kc, whatever the rating is for that receiver. Now, a unscrupulous manufacturer, again, even with that test, back in the old days of 20 dB of quieting, could choose a super narrow IF strip. A narrow IF strip lets in less noise, therefore when you measure 20 dB of quieting with a pure sine wave, unmodulated carrier coming out of a signal generator, to come up with a beautiful sounding number. But if the IF strip is so narrow that a normal amplitude, correction, frequency modulated signal bangs up against the sides of that IF strip, it'll give you a terrible sounding signal. You know what a signal sounds like when a guy is, say, 5 kc upset. And so a IF strip that's too narrow and an FM receiver will sound like that. And that's a kind of yucky distortion, a real clattery sound to the voice. So by making a 12 dB SINAD measurement, signal plus noise and distortion, you're creating a level playing field for an FM receiver sensitivity measurement. Because a guy who makes the receiver too narrow, the 3 or 5 kc, whatever the desired deviation of the FM is, will be slamming up against the sides of the IF, making a residual amplitude modulation because of the skirts of that filter, driving the limiter discriminator crazy and give you a pretty distorted output. The guy who makes a good receiver is one who makes the IF strip just the right width, with just the right shape for the IF strip, shape of its bandpass, such that it passes the main signal and the majority of the FM-generated sidebands. Puts them all through the receiver with the right amplitude ratio and the right phase ratio. In other words, he's controlled the group delay distortion. I know, we're getting deep here. But a good IF strip has got the right bandwidth, the right shape, the right group delay distortion, so that your FM-modulated signal with all of its individual major side lobes comes through with no amplitude distortion or phase distortion. The discriminator puts it all back together, comes back out with some audio, and that audio, if you've done a good job, has a very low distortion, like 0.3%. That's part of what the SINAD meter is measuring. It's again a way of levering the playing field. noise figure was invented back in the days when amplitude modulation was popular and people were using super narrow receivers, IF strips. Dynad is invented back in the more modern days of FM receivers, when again people were using IF strips that are too narrow. And so it levels the playing field. I know we got off the subject, Mel. Sorry about that. K2KEY, you better get back to your questions. K2RIW, wait for me.
Let me make one more quick comment on this.
Go ahead.
When you want to tune up a receiver, you want to do a DBH and acceptance test. You want to come up to maybe 5.5 and 6 and see if it still works. That means you want to see if you get distortion. Also, you want to raise your deviation to, let's say, 5.25 kc's and make sure you got your IF symmetrically extended. That means you may want to take, you want to sweep the IF and see if the shape looks correct. That means if you are tuning up an IF strip, you want to make sure all your IF circuits are nicely set up and that you can get as maximum amount of deviation as possible, and you make sure you set it on frequency over to you.
So as you can see from what, let me drop it. From what Howie is saying, even though you've got a very good design of a good FM receiver, that's got great dynamic range and great noise figure, there still is an art and science to properly aligning the cascaded filters of the IF strip to get the right shape, the right flatness, the right group delay distortion, the right phase shift, all that kind of jazz. To make the FM signal in all of its sidebands tunnel down through that IF strip and all of its filters in the proper way, so that when it arrives at the limited discriminator, it gives you nice, clean audio. There's an art and science to doing that alignment. It's more than just picking it up, so to speak. K2KEY, K2RIW in TechNet. Boy, have we got in the field here.
K2KEY. Well, that's why I didn't want to get into receiving. I just wanted to touch upon this with the bandwidth situations and let it go, because we're going to... I was going to stay with DB. It's getting kind of late, so I'm not going to get into this really next month, because this is another doozy, and this will get into this is a creative one, let's put it this way, and that's use of Q, the Q factor, and DB, and some very unusual manipulations. I don't know where the heck they got this from, but I think I'll let that go for next week, Dick, because it's getting late. I think they may shut the repeater down or whatever, but we may have lost a lot of the audience with the delay, the time. So I'll leave Q and DD for next week. Over.
And for quite a few weeks, there's been something I've been forgetting to mention to you guys. I'm very guilty about this one. Okay. There are fans out there of the TechNet that have a degree of love for it that just blows my mind. One of those guys is Terry, KC2MJI, Kilo Charlie 2, November, Juliet, India. He has created one hell of a website. Go to his website, www.amateurradio.tv. I'll spell that out. There's a double R in there. A-M-A-T-E-U-R. R-A-D-I-O, double R, amateurradio.tv. He has been making tape recordings of the TechNet since September 10th, 1996. So far, on that website, since the beginning of January up until the present time, you can play back the streaming audio of every past TechNet. That's just the beginning. Every single TechNet, every minute of the conversation, what was the subject being discussed, has been categorized. So you go to the adjacent panel of explanation for the TechNet material. You can find out what subject was discussed, during what hour, during which tape recording. And you go to that particular recording, and that many minutes downrange, and listen to that subject if you want. He has created a library of past information about the TechNet. So let me repeat that. www.amateurradio.tv, AmateurRadio, no punctuation between amateur and radio. So www.amateurradio.tv. You go there to that website, and one of the many things you'll find is past TechNet, all categorized with streaming audio that you can play back. I wonder if you've heard about this one so far, Ralph. As I said, this letter was given to me in February 7th. Arrived in my house, February 24th. So, the letter was dated February 7th, but it arrived at my house February 24th. Doesn't matter. Anyhow, I've been kind of quiet about that all this time for silly reasons. I don't know why. Just didn't get around to mentioning it. So, if you're a real fan of the Technet, this came about in particular because a guy, let me drop it. A guy wrote me a letter saying that, hey, I go on trips on Sunday night for my company, and I've set up tape recordings, and I've set up a VoIP, and all kinds of ways to try to get the audio of the TechNet. So I told him the simple technique would be to set a timer on a tape recorder in front of his radio when he's gone, and maybe have the wife turn it on and turn it off at the right time. But now, I think with about a week delay or so, you can go to the website and hear the streaming audio of that particular TechNet. K2KEY, you might want to make a comment on this one. This blows my mind. K2LIW.
Roger, I got it. Date February 7th here. I haven't pulled it out of the file yet. It's quite something, really. And KC2NJI, South Fort, Jersey. And he asked me for a number of feedbacks on it. And look, let me put it this way, go over all of it. There's some mountain of stuff there, Dick. I looked at it. It's tremendous. And I guess we did a lot of those discussions. We covered this business with the receivers in detail. That's why I stayed away from it tonight. And I just say we'll leave from the DD, I think, for tonight, because I get a lot of more questions on my email about DD. And I'll get into this. This, like I say, this is good for listening next week. So this is a real dupe if you're interested in DB, especially as a when we talk about DB and Q. I had to really scratch my head on this one, but I think I've got it boiled down to really a quite a discussion. So, like I say, it's a little late, so I think we better not pick up on that. K2RIW, the TechNet, KTKY.
All you need to know is 3 dB points, 0.707.
There's four definitions of the word Q, Howie. Voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance, energy dissipated per cycle divided by energy stored per cycle, into energy stored per cycle, and lower 3 dB bandwidth, upper 3 dB bandwidth, that ratio divided to the center frequency, geometric mean center frequency. So there's four definitions of Q of a resonant circuit. Most antennas are a resonant circuit. As an occupation, almost every day of the week, I fight the battle of my particular employer. Once the antenna smaller and smaller, squeezed into a tinier and tinier volume of space, and he wants more and more performance. When you make an antenna small, in order to meet the requirements of the industrial designers, you end up with an antenna that suddenly becomes very high in Q and very narrow in bandwidth. So every day of my life, to some degree, for the last umpty-umpty years, I've been fighting the battle of what is the realizable Q in the available space for the antenna at that particular frequency, and will it meet the requirements to do what the radio system has got to do. So Q becomes darn important when you're working with electrically small antennas. A guy named Harold Wheeler, who used to run the Wheeler Laboratory on Long Island, I think it was Sciatis, and he's written a whole bunch of articles, very respected articles over the years. And by the way, in his later years, he became a ham radio operator. I don't know if he survived long enough to really enjoy it, but anyhow, he's written a lot of good technical information. And so he's written the classic articles. When you go to the chapter 3 or 4, I think it is, of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, you'll see that that chapter was written by Harold Wheeler on electrically small antennas. And he's got a way of describing what, within the laws of physics, can you achieve in realizable Q, realizable, usable bandwidth of an antenna when you squeeze it into a small space. You pay the price. when it comes to simple antennas like dipoles, everyone believes that the gain goes to zero as the size goes to zero. Good common sense. Dead wrong. If you're smart enough to be able to do a good job of impedance matching that dipole, and you make that dipole of infinitesimal size, you make it smaller and smaller, but keep impedance matching it with good circuitry that is lossless, the gain of the dipole stays almost the same. You lose 7/10 of a dB, or is it 1.25 dB? A very small number. But the bandwidth becomes so narrow that you can't use it easily anymore. You can't keep it on frequency. It doesn't include the modulation sideband. There's a number of disadvantages. And I'm currently working on a scheme to try to get around that, and it's a toughie. Another whole subject, as you can tell. There are people who have put a good fraction of their career. Harold Wheeler put a good fraction of his career in very high-tech engineering and engineering writing on the subject of electrically small antennas and controlling their Q, controlling their bandwidth, controlling the amount of stored energy per cycle versus dissipated energy per cycle, or controlling the amount of voltage rise at resonance. As you make that antenna infinitesimally small, the voltage on the tips of the antenna will rise. And how far can you take it? Eventually, you literally arc over the air between the tips of the antenna as you make it small enough to keep pouring the exact same amount of power into it. That's the limit. Well, then you can put it inside of a Jennings vacuum variable capacitor, I guess, or put it into outer space, and you can stop the arc over if you like. There's funny things that can be done. Another whole subject. Okay, this was TechNet number 1,100, and let's see what the hell number it was there. And by the way, hey, we got to be careful what we say here now. It's being recorded. 1,134 of the series that began in September of 1982. As long as Mel and I stay healthy and we're still full of blank and vinegar, we'll be back next week and discuss more of these decibels and cues and all this other electronic jazz. And there's more where that came from. For right, Mel, tell them there's more where that came from. KTKUSK2LIW.
Comment into Leo.
And into Andy.
Bell first. Go ahead, Bell.
One more comment, Dick, about small antennas, which a lot of hams don't know about. And if you give me the chance, I'll be glad to do it.
Bell first. Go ahead, Bell, with some closing comments. More, Bell, is there more where that came from?
Well, this is KUKY. That's why I want to leave this for next week, because we're going to get into a very interesting concept. Somebody, I guess we've got people out there that are trying to catch us. And this one is really, I could say, a real beaut with the Q and DB and applications. And again, a very unusual situation. So we'll leave that for next week. And I try to keep it on subject. You see, it's very nice to, of course, rehash, you know, things like discussion on receivers and all. But according to the conversation, you know, with this gentleman's recording it, we're better off, you know, trying to stay with the particular subject that we started with on our, you know, discussions that night, whether we went through the Smith charts, we went through vectors, we went through polar and rectangular causes. You know, I try to stay with it. So I wanted to stay with DBs and not get off on any tangent. Just happened to be this one question, you know, crept in about bandwidth and receiving. So that's why I did get off only a bit on that. So ideally, Dick, I think we should try to stay with, you know, the particular question. Creates a lot less confusion. Go ahead.
With this particular crowd, that's tough. Maybe with me. I like what's called divergence analysis. You know, the guy is discussing audio, and someone in the back of the room says, oh, if we add some infrared, we'll make it better. N2EO, go ahead, Rich, with your comment.
Hey, Dick. Just wanted to make a comment. Unrelated, tonight's kind of an important night for me. It's 1 year ago tonight that I had the stroke, and I didn't obey the warning signs. I didn't know the warning signs. For like 3 days prior, I was getting dizzy, what they call vertigo, double vision, trying to think what else. And It was tonight, 1 year ago, that I fell asleep in the ham shack, woke up at 6 in the morning, and couldn't walk, fell into a state of confusion, like a twilight state for about 3 weeks, and then made a comeback. Just wanted to say, anybody has any of those symptoms, or which would include, but doesn't have to include, slurred speech, headache, vertigo, double vision, loss of vision in one eye. Those are the warning signs. Get yourself to a hospital. Back to that.
Yeah, there was a, that's good to keep in mind, to look for the warning signs. One of the articles that I've seen repeated a couple of times, there's four things you're supposed to do to find out whether or not a person had a stroke. One was to ask him to smile. Another one was to ask him to compose a simple sentence. Another was to ask him to put both arms up in the air. It turns out that in many strokes, one side of the body is affected and the guy can't put both arms up in the air. He can't smile equally on both sides of his face. He can't compose a sentence. And I forget what the fourth one was. But if the person fails any one of those four tests, it's time to bring them to a physician or to a hospital real fast. Because the stroke really means that a portion of the brain is being starved from oxygen, and the longer you wait, the more the damage might occur. So you get them to the right physician early enough, and a lot of the damage can be avoided. I know that Barry wanted to make another comment. Into Moonbound. Go ahead, Barry.
Okay, I'm just putting all the pieces together on the table here. Yes, actually related to the antenna subject, smaller and smaller antenna. About 2 weeks ago, I brought up an antenna that a fellow in Jersey appears to be working on, and did you ever take a look at that website of his? I don't think that the antenna is really any different. I think it's just another way of folding a pretzel, but his claims are awful good, I'll tell you that, Dick.
I'd better look at it. And no, I've got a list here of things that I got to do immediately. But my daughter's mortgage and the IRS, I got a couple things to come before that. There's a couple of crises that are higher on the list than that one, Barry. But I'll try to get to it. Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, okay. I did the IRS thing already this week, so. Oh Lord, they promised they're going to give me money back, Dick. I should live so long.
Okay. well. It's very difficult to get the equation just right where you give them just the right amount so that they're not acting as a zero interest savings account for you, or vice versa, where you owe them so much that they want you to pay them interest. It's kind of difficult to get the W-4 just right so that the W-2 comes out right. You know what I mean? Good luck with that. I know that, let's see, I think it's Howie wants to make another comment. Go ahead, Howie.
MDP
recognized.
MDP. Yeah, Dick, I just want to make a comment about small antennas. See a lot of hams now operating small loaded antennas in their apartments on 80 and 40. And I just hope people realize that when you get to small antennas, you get a higher and higher voltage field and it can be more biohazard. Hope guys realize that. I see guys trying to get these small antennas, base antennas, small dipoles in their apartment. When the antenna's half wavelength, there ain't that much damage, but when you start getting into 16th wave or super loaded antennas, watch out for the voltage.
Well, actually, it's actually watch out for the local flux density, power flux density, watts per square meter. If your antenna is still reading a kilowatt, and your antenna is only a couple of meters square, when it used to be 130 feet long, and you're still radiating a kilowatt, the watts per square meter is going up real fast. If you stand close to it, there's more H field, there's more E field, there's more pointing vectors, there's more power flux density. There's more stuff that's going to come get you. Be careful. Steve, go right ahead.
Yeah, Dick, I just got a quick question on that website that you mentioned before. That's amateurradio1word.com. I just tried it, and I got nowhere. It's basically said it's, the website doesn't exist. Back to you.
You added it, .com, it doesn't exist. www.amateurradio.tv. Stop. Amateurradio.tv. There ain't no common there. I'm back to you, Steve.
Okay, very good. Thanks for clarifying that. I'll give it another try. TC2 QIQ.
QIQ, go right ahead. Why in the world am I... Oh, yes. Glenn, you got it, Glenn.
Yeah, I got kind of a quick question. It might be stupid, actually, but I guess a question I always have is, you know, being an electrical engineer, I work with electrical resonance, you know, and know how to calculate it. And then I look at antennas, and then we talk about quarter wavelength, half wavelength, as resonance length. But normally when I think of resonance, I'm always thinking of high reactive energy and basically energy not doing work. Why is the term, you know, coined for antennas resonance when they're at quarter and half wavelength?
Oh boy, have I got a story for you, Glenn. Just because your antenna is exactly the right half wavelength and length at some reasonable altitude, just because you measure 72 ohms of characteristic resistive impedance, just because it has no reactance, so in other words, its impedance is 72RJ0, very ideal dipole. We all sit here and think that our, if we were using 72 ohm twin lead to feed it, balanced feeding from a 72 ohm transmitter, and we put 100 watts into it, we'd like to believe the 100 watts goes down that feed line, hits the 72 ohm antenna, and jumps into space. Beautiful sounding story. Lie. Dead wrong. You study what's going on. You look at Chapter 4 of Antenna Engineering Handbook, and I think it's the graph 4.4 and 4-4 and 4-5 up here. One graph is all the resistance values for any reasonable length of monopole, any reasonable length and any reasonable diameter. All the resistors on the first graph, I think it's 4-4, and the second graph, I think it's 4-5, all the reactance values for all reasonable lengths and all reasonable diameters. You study that curve and you suddenly realize something really funny is going on. When you make the antenna a little bit longer or a little bit shorter, then exactly halfway, all of a sudden we say the antenna is reactive. You study it and you realize that you can deviate quite far in distance, make it longer and shorter. The resistive component moves a little bit. The 72 ohms goes to 74 if you're making it longer. The 72 ohms goes to 69 or 68 if you make it shorter. It moves slowly in resistance. You study the reactance curve and you suddenly realize, oh, hell is breaking loose. You make it just a few percent longer. And all of a sudden, the reactive component that used to be zero just jumped up to 1,500 ohm reactive component. And you say to yourself, what in the world is going on here? And here's my understanding of it. Let me drop. You'll not read this in any good antenna book, and I'm very disappointed about that. Assume I'm putting a perfect sine wave at your favorite frequency into that antenna. I'm going through positive, negative, back to zero again in my normal sine wave. I decide to stop the action and analyze at the positive peak. So the right-hand side of the dipole is positive at the peak point, the left-hand side is negative. I know that that positive pulse I just put on to the antenna is going to travel a quarter wave to the right on the right-hand side of the dipole. It's going to take a quarter wave in time to get there. It's going to hit the egg insulator at the far right-hand side. It's an open circuit without phase reversal. That signal reversed, it'll come back toward the center because not all of it gets radiated. Boy, is that an understatement. And the signal comes back another quarter wavelength of time. By the time it gets back, that positive pulse, a total of half wave in time has occurred. The transmitter, when I started my analysis, was putting out maximum positive voltage. Half wave later, the transmitter is putting out maximum negative voltage. So the voltage that went down and came back, assume it was positive 1 volt that went out, and positive 1 volt comes back, but the transmitter is now putting out negative 1 volt. As far as that signal is concerned, it's nearly a short circuit. Very little of the energy gets absorbed, and it gets rebounced forward again. The signal is bouncing back and forth, on average, on a real dipole, roughly 30 times before it gets radiated into space. I'm going to repeat that. Roughly 30 times the signal bounces back and forth. Let me drop for a second. When you make the antenna a little bit longer or a little bit shorter, the amount of time, if I make it a little bit longer, the amount of time it takes to get out to the right-hand tip is delayed. And when it comes back, it's double delayed. And so Now, what comes back is not exactly 180 degrees out of phase. It's lagging. And we call that inductive reactance. The fact that the reactance moves so damn fast when you make a little bit of change in the length of the antenna, or conversely make a little bit of change in the frequency you're feeding into the antenna, tells me right away the signal is bouncing back and forth a whole lot of time. Your perfect full half-wave dipole mounted in free space is running at a standing wave ratio of roughly 30 to 1. That's why the reactance builds up so fast. What we call resonance, making the antenna tuned to the center frequency, means that those 30 bounces all stay in phase with each other, and there ain't no reactive component. Radiation is hard. You have to kick that signal in the tail 30 times in a row before it finally jumps off that antenna and leaps into space. It doesn't do it all at once. It does it continuously. But it's an exponential decay of the original pulse you're putting in, and you continue putting in more of them. Radiation is hard. That's why the phase of the signal changes so fast as a function of length. This you cannot read in any of the antenna books, but it gives me an immediate understanding of what's really happening. I wonder if it made any sense to you, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KC2QIQ. Yeah, no, you make a very interesting point, because I've kind of been, you know, doing a lot of measurements on antennas recently, and I'm coming to exactly the same conclusion, that what's actually happening here is the energy required to build the field around the outside of the antenna is really where the R radiation is coming from. And when I'm modeling it, like when I'm doing loop antennas, I'm finding out that as I get to, you know, model the inductive reactance and the, you know, series RDC, the R radiation is actually in parallel with the inductive reactance, because if I were to calculate the inductive reactance in the warm loop, the impedance is very, very high, and it looks as if it's getting choked off, and there's no power going through there. But when I measure the reactance with an analyzer, I'm seeing that it almost appears as if that inductive reactance in the RDC and RAC are in parallel with the R radiation. And that's why it brings up the point of, like, this doesn't look like a real resonance here. It really looks like, you know, building up a radiation field around the outside of the antenna, and it drops the impedance in parallel with the inductive reactance of the warm loop wire.
There's many, many ways of looking at this one, Glenn. You can come up with a valid equivalent circuit for your antenna with the R, L, and C are in series. You can come up with an equivalent circuit, if you're plotting them, where the R, L, and C are in parallel. And you come up with other combinations. Once you understand your model and dot all the I's, cross all the T's correctly, the model will work. The bottom line of all this is that for any reasonable size antenna, by reasonable size I mean I'm negating now the 15 wavelength long rhombic and the 20 wavelength long beverage. I'm throwing those away temporarily. For reasonable size antennas, you will resonate the antenna first and radiate second. I'm going to reword that. You will resonate the radiating system first. You resonate the radiating system first, then it has the ability to radiate at reasonable percentage of radiation. Now, when I say resonate the radiating system, I mean the thing you call antenna, the thing you call feed line, the thing you call antenna tuner, impedance matcher, and probably including the final tank circuit of your tube transmitter. But in the old-fashioned days when it was a pie tank circuit, that was the impedance matcher. So if I put together in a lump, in a black box, the pi L, the pi tank circuit, the antenna tuner, the feed line, hopefully low and long, and the antenna, that combination, you will electronically resonate it first if you wanted to radiate anything like 80 or 90 or 98% efficiency of what you put into it. You resonate first, then it has the ability to build up the fields you're talking about, and then radiate. Radiation is hard. From an antenna point of view, from an antenna designer point of view, we want 98% efficiency. I want to put a watt in there, and I want 0.98 watts to be coupled into space in the right direction. If I'm an electromagnetic compatibility engineer, electromagnetic interference engineer, I want non-radiation. I want the signal flowing down that cable to be 60, 70, 80, 90 dB attenuated before it couples into the adjacent circuit. His definition of radiation is 60 to 80 dB down. Your and my definition of radiation is a half a dB down or less. They're very different criteria. With our criteria, you and I will resonate the radiating system first, then it has the ability to radiate. Violate that law, and you will not radiate, by our definition. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
K2MB, question.
Just really quick, thanks a lot, Dick. At least I don't feel so alone now, thinking about the ways the antenna's being modeled. Very good explanation. Thanks again.
You got it, sir. Barry.
Okay. If RF is coming, is in a tank circuit and moving through the feed line and going into the antenna, are you telling me, which I agree with you, by the way, that the antenna, I guess you call it ringing, the signal is going to be going back and forth through this. Now, that's going to take a finite amount of time. So I've got two ways to ask this question. If you were to transmit for only one cycle, and you shut the transmitter off, just one complete cycle, at the speed of light, this thing is moving, or actually less because of the delay in the wire, is moving in and out of its cable. You should be able to hear the signal probably 30 or 40 times coming out of the antenna with the receiver, even after you've shut the transmitter off after that single cycle. This should go on for 30 or 40 more cycles. Now, you're saying it's the RF in the antenna going back, you know, and forth. You know, I think it's the tank circuit ringing. Because if you were to excite the tank circuit for one cycle and then shut off the RF, wouldn't the tank circuit continue to ring 30 or 40 times? Over.
It's both a yes and a no answer to what you just said, Barry. If I have a low loss feed line, a real Q of 10 tank circuit, and a Q of 30 antenna, these are approximately the real numbers. The majority of the stored energy is in the antenna, but 30% of the stored energy is in the tank circuit, and there's also some stored energy in the cable, depending on the length of the cable. Now, the experiment that you just described, I did that experiment, and I did it at X-Band, I did it at the Benningfield Anechoic Facility at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and I did that in 1990, March 15th, a day that shall live in infamy in my life. On that particular day, I finally perfected a system that didn't radiate one cycle, it radiated three cycles. Exactly three cycles at X-band. A quarter of a nanosecond of total signal. At the speed of light, that signal was 4 inches long from the leading edge of the signal to the back edge of the signal as it radiated in the space of that chamber. I built a radar that could resolve each individual cone of the anechoic material on the floor, each nail that people had dropped, each adapter that people had dropped, to the nearest 4 inches. I could wave that antenna around that chamber. The antenna just happened to be connected to a great big airplane, and I rotated the whole damn airplane. They did it for me. But you know what I mean. I sent out this pencil beam of a signal. It was like a flashlight. I slowly turned that antenna 1 degree every 3 seconds, turned that whole damn airplane 1 degree every 3 seconds, and flashed that around the chamber and recorded those signals. And I can tell you exactly how many feet out, 1 nanosecond per foot, where all of the signals, where all of the reflecting objects, in what direction, and how many feet out. And you walked out into the chamber, that many feet, you reached down, and there was the nail. There was the connector. There was the chunk of metal, the wrench that somebody had dropped into the phone. So I did that experiment. I was using a sampling oscilloscope that was measuring the sine wave. Not the envelope, the sine wave, degree by degree, up to 22 nanoseconds, up to 22 gigahertz, a quarter of a nanosecond pulse with a triangular envelope, very important. I didn't make it a rectangular pulse. I made a triangular envelope pulse, exactly 3 cycles long, and I watched the ring. I was using very broadband antennas with very low Q, and they had very low ring. But if I was doing it with a dipole, I would have been able to see those rings for 30 individual cycles, just like you're describing. And yes, when you add the tank circuit, let me drop for a second. You add the tank circuit, and the amount of ring is going to be extended because the tank circuit has got almost as much Q as the antenna. but you and I can make the tank circuit go away, Barry. I can take that transmitter of yours, I can put it through a 30 decibel high power attenuator. I've now got a pure 50 ohm load that any energy that gets reflected back to that load will be absorbed. I can now put a brief pulse through that pad into your antenna, and I can watch your antenna itself ring. The ring will now be quite a bit shorter because of the energy reflecting back and forth. Some of it is traveling back down the transmission line and being absorbed. So now the ring is going to be much, much shorter. But by comparing the ring with a perfect dummy load, by comparison to a real tank circuit with a constant current generator of a real tetrode tube, I can, if I'm smart enough, I can now resolve exactly how much stored energy there is in my tank, how much stored energy there is in my transmission line, and how much stored energy is in my antenna. And the stored energy in the antenna is damn significant. It's a high-key structure. You may think your antenna, when you make a measurement at your favorite center frequency, might be 3,800 kilohertz, is exactly a one-to-one standing wave ratio. But if you then move your point of measurement, not at the input terminals of the antenna, but you move it 1 inch downrange onto the wire of the right-hand side of the dipole, and you re-measure the visuar, you'll come up with a number like 30 to 1. N2 moon bounce, K2LIW.
Okay, so you're telling me that if you could disconnect the feed line from the antenna after a single cycle of energy, the antenna would still go on to ring. And the number 30 is superfluous. I think what's happening here is there is energy being radiated each time, and after you reach about 30 rings, it becomes an insignificant amount of energy. But I guess in some mathematical equation, you could ask the question, does it ever stop? I mean, it should get weaker and weaker and weaker. What is the point that you say there is no longer a signal here?
Which is very equivalent, Barry, is if I'm in free space, and you keyed your handy talkie, and you're transmitting to me, and I start up 1 foot away from you, and I back away to 1,000 feet, a mile, 2 miles, 10 miles, where does the signal disappear? The answer is never. It gets weaker and weaker. At some particular point, the signal is so weak that it's not good enough with the particular receiver I'm using now to give me more money to build a bigger antenna and a more sensitive receiver with a lower noise figure to allow me to go into space where the background is quieter, 3 degrees Kelvin, and I'll get weaker and weaker signals. Where does it disappear? Never. Once you and I create a radio wave, Barry, it goes to every single cubic centimeter of this universe, without exception. You create that radio wave, it goes everywhere. With all of those bounces, it goes everywhere. The only thing left for you and I to discuss is, at the point I care about to receive that signal, is it about the threshold of the receiver I'm using today? Back to you, Barry.
Okay, I think we should continue this next week. When you get a chance, speaking of antennas, take a look at this guy's little tiny 75-meter antenna. It's an interesting design. I think what he's done is he's doing the same thing that everybody else is doing, but he's very carefully avoided having, you know, these connections at high current points. By virtue of his little design there, he's managed to avoid all the things where you lose signal in that kind of an antenna. It's probably, I think it has a much higher Q than he says it has, but I don't know. Take a look. And I'll see you next week. And by the way, very interesting night tonight. I really enjoyed this net. The only part I didn't like was the vomit comment part, but what are you going to do? Take to RW and to Andrew.
Yeah, I got a kind of a not-so-pleasant picture of a poor guy choking to death while having not enough muscle control floating in the vomit comment. Okay. 73, well, we tried. Mel and I tried to cut this off 45 minutes ago. We really got to leave. 70 to you guys. Bye-bye. More to follow. K2RW, TechNet Landmark. We're clear.
Dick, all I can say is a pleasure. You have a great evening, a great week, Dick. K2RW, WB2HWW. Another one for practical.
If I keep sending you checks, will you keep saying that, Howie?
Send me a check for heaven here, dollars. I'll pay for that. 1,000 years. No, seriously. I think it's very...